Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
The fight over dark money at the Arizona Corporation Commission is heating up. On Friday, Arizona Public Service filed its response to a subpoena from Commissioner Bob Burns, saying it has no intention of turning over all the records he's demanded. Burns wants financial documents related to the utility's alleged spending on commission races during the 2014 election cycle. KJZZ's Will Stone has been following the story closely and joins me. So, Will, why is APS not turning over this information?
There's a host of reasons they are saying they will not comply with this subpoena, Steve. But first and foremost, they say it's basically an overreach of the commissioner's authority to demand that not only APS, but also its parent company, Pinnacle West, reveal how it's been spending money that's not coming from ratepayers, the so-called below-the-line spending. And they really say that what's being asked for has no relevance to the commission's job setting rates. More broadly, they argue this is an infringement on the company's First Amendment rights. It's essentially protected political speech, and that the commissioner's demand for this information would expose confidential material, along with some other arguments. But those are some of the main bullet points. And now this all stems from, you know, what's widely believed to have been $3 million in so-called dark money. It was spent by an independent expenditure on the races for commissioners Doug Little and Tom Farese 2 years ago. Bob Burns has said this is made this a sort of crusade of his and fighting to have them reveal this spending.
Well, this is a really broad story, but as far as how we got here, this conflict directly between Burns and APS, how long has that been going on, and what's some of the steps that we've led to here?
As I mentioned, Burns has been hammering away at this for months, and there's been a number of back and forths. It started with Burns asking APS to voluntarily reveal this information. They rejected that. He'd also asked that all the utilities, but APS as well, to voluntarily refrain from spending on future elections, and they rebuffed that request as well. And so the subpoena was really Burns' final option. And he'd even indicated prior to this that he was skeptical APS would get on board. So most people who've been watching this didn't expect it to just resolve nicely and that it probably would end up in court.
Well, so clearly then not a surprise that APS reacted this way.
No. Every indication from letters sent by the company CEO has been, you know, this is a gross overreach of your authority. And the company has publicly will neither confirm nor deny whether it was behind the spending. But no one really expected they would just get on board.
So did APS say anything else about if it will reveal the information at any point?
APS said it will give certain public documents that are responsive to Burns' investigation into whether ratepayer funds were used, although, of course, they did say no ratepayer funds were used. The company has also said it would provide some other material pending a kind of confidentiality agreement. But clearly, this is not what Burns has been asking for. His whole point here has been transparency, making the public know whether a regulated utility was behind political spending. There was also no mention in APS's response about its parent company, Pinnacle West, giving them any documentation. But recently, there was an opinion from Attorney General Mark Brnovich on this issue. And the way that Burns interpreted that opinion, he believed that it gave a single commissioner the power to force a publicly traded company like Pinnacle West to disclose this spending. But the documents filed by the utility and Pinnacle West's lawyers say that is not true at all. And they really call this, in pretty strong language, harassment, that he's really just targeting them. And they've actually begun to turn the argument around on him, saying that you are actually using this issue strategically to influence this current election. Don't forget, Bob Burns is running for re-election on the commission, and this has been the centerpiece of his campaign.
So the tone of this response really has APS battling back.
Yes. They say they will take any means necessary to fight this, including taking it to the highest court. They've filed a couple documents in Superior Court and then several documents with the Corporation Commission. So now we'll just see where it goes from here and how Commissioner Burns responds.
KJZZ's Will Stone with a continuing saga of the Arizona Corporation Commission. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Late Friday afternoon, we got new developments in the race for the Congressional District 5 GOP primary as Andy Biggs extended his small lead over Christine Jones. But there is new information that happened this morning, and the man who's been covering this story is KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, what occurred this morning?
So this morning, Steve, what we had was the recorder's office took the new vote tally to the Board of Supervisors, which, like you said, has Senate President Andy Biggs now up 16 votes over former GoDaddy executive Christine Jones. And the Board of Supervisors approved that vote total. Now it's sent to the Secretary of State, who will then do their own what we call canvas or certification.
Jimmy, we're all getting anxious. What's the timeline for this to play out?
Next, because we are in within the threshold of a recount, the Secretary of State is going to ask a judge to proceed with that recount because the difference between Jones and Biggs is less than that margin of 0.1% of their combined vote total. We have to go to a recount.
And when does the recount get started?
Okay, Steve, so take heart because the end is in sight. Elizabeth Bartholomew with the recorder's office says they plan on starting the recount tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
We're hoping to be done by the end of this week. We're probably thinking the counting is going to take 2 to 3 days, and we do need to do a hand count at the end of tabulating all the ballots, and we have to hand count 5% of the precincts to certify that we are getting the same results as what our machine gave us.
Now, Steve, they're up against a hard deadline here because they have to print the general election ballots and mail them out to military and overseas voters by September 24th. So after they recount, they'll have to have the Board of Supervisors certify again, and then the Secretary of State does another canvass, and that should be it.
Jimmy, at the practical level, how much is this going to cost?
The recorder's office told me that they're estimating between $5,000 and $9,000 for the recount, and the state is the one that pays for it.
So, Jimmy, has Arizona gone through this before in recent history?
The last time we had a congressional recount was in 2014, when Martha McSally edged out Ron Barber in the general election for the 2nd congressional district. That took a little over 2 weeks, but that was a general election recount. This is just the Republican primary. Bartholomew told me the last time they conducted a recount, it was for a proposition, but there wasn't much change, just a few votes.
But we're talking about just a few votes in this election, too.
That's true, Steve. Stay tuned. We'll keep you updated.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins with the latest on Congressional District 5 and the GOP primary. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
The concept of early voting has been embraced by a huge majority of states. 37 of them, including Arizona, give voters the chance to cast a ballot before Election Day. By most accounts, it's been a success, at least to the extent that it increases scheduling flexibility for people who really want to make sure they vote. But in a column this month for National Review Online, writer Jim Garrity argues that, quote, early voting now represents a good idea run amok. He continues, quote, new laws that aim to make casting a ballot easier and more convenient for busy voters have created election month. In some states, voters have 6 weeks to pull the lever. For a response to Garrity's column, I'm joined by Alberto Olivas, executive director of the Ed Pastor Center for Politics and Public Service at ASU. Alberto, why do you think the concept of early voting is a good one?
So early voting was proposed and changed from absentee voting, where you had to have a reason to vote before the day of the election, to open access early voting, where any voter can request to have the ballot sent to them by mail, to increase voter turnout and to really be an option for voters that for very many reasons have challenges or obstacles with voting in person on the day of the election. That's a lot of different groups we're talking about. We're a state that has a lot of rural communities and tribal communities where the polling place might be located significantly far from where voters live. And I know in at least in the 90s, we had many tribal communities where people would, it would be a journey of a day to get to the polling place and back again. And the transportation challenges generally are more significant for people that are not well off financially. So getting to the polls on election day is a big deal, especially if you're working a job where it's you have to go in early and leave late.
Some will say that, yes, the campaign is too long sort of generally, but in this case, with early voting, it almost compresses the campaign too much. Let's say from Arizona's primary day, people will be able to start voting in early October, and that is only just a little more than a month from the primary election. Does that give the candidates going from primary to general a chance to really get their message out to enough voters?
I think so, and the smart candidates will have already strategized around that. This is not a new thing in our state, and candidates in Arizona have been building their strategies around the drop date for the early ballots when those get mailed out. So candidates already know what they need to do. I mean, if if they're prepared, they know how to build their strategies around early voting behavior. I'm less concerned about, you know, what's effective and what's convenient for candidates and ballot issue campaigns as I am for what can we do to make voting as convenient and as trouble-free for as many voters as possible. And for a state like ours with 13 out of 15 counties or as rural counties, and with many communities that have significant issues with getting to the polling places, especially in our tribal communities, I think the benefits of having the early ballot available to all voters far outweigh the concerns that campaign managers might have.
And as part of the work you do, it's getting young people interested in public service. I imagine that includes being interested in voting and being high-efficacy voters. Do you think this is something that will help keep younger voters interested, this idea that they don't need to have an actual election day, that they can vote a little bit at their own convenience? Or in some ways, some traditionalists might argue, does it make election day less special to young people voting for the first time?
I would say no. In fact, I would counter the argument that it's either or. One thing we know a lot of people do with their early ballots when they receive them in the mail is they hold on to them. So one of the arguments against it is, well, what if people vote early and then something happens that would have changed their mind? But the preponderance of people that get the mail ballot hold on to them, and they're thinking about that. You know, I'm 90% sure on this candidate, but I just want to see what happens. Or they just procrastinate. I'm one of these people. I've been on the permanent early voting list since it was available, and I almost always end up having to bring my ballot to the polls on election day, and that's fine. So you can have the best of both worlds. You can get the ballot early and take a lot of time to research all the down ballot stuff that tends not to get attention by the media, and look at, you know, the city races and the ballot issues and the judges and all the other things that show up on the ballot, and then drop it off at the polls on election day. And that's another benefit if you are one of these voters that receives a ballot by mail, is if there's a line, you don't have to wait in the line. You can just march right in and drop off your ballot and get your sticker and be on your way.
Alberto Olivas is the executive director of the Pastor Center for Politics and Public Service at ASU. We've been talking about early voting. Latino population growth in the U.S. is slowing down. The Pew Research Center shows that expansion was only 2.8% a year from 2007 to 2014, down from 4.4% in the 7 years before that. Mark Hugo Lopez, director of Hispanic Research for Pew, is with me to explain more. And Mark, why the slowdown among U.S. Latinos?
Well, there's actually two big reasons. The first is immigration from Latin America, particularly Mexico, has slowed significantly in the last 10 years. And if you take a look particularly at Mexican migration, you actually see that since 2009, there's actually been a reversal with more Mexicans returning to Mexico than actually arriving in the United States. The second big reason is that fertility among Hispanic women has declined in recent years. You see this when you see this among particularly U.S.-born Hispanics. Their fertility rates are looking more and more like Americans overall. But when you take a look at particularly immigrant Hispanics, we don't have as many immigrants arriving, so there's not as many young Hispanic immigrant women coming to the United States. That means that most of the fertility rates for Hispanics are being driven by the U.S.-born, who tend to have lower fertility rates to begin with.
Do these numbers in any way quantify the theories of some that after the Great Recession and in the years that happened, a few years after that, let's say at least until 2010, 2011 maybe, was that indicative as well? You were seeing fewer immigrants because perhaps there were fewer jobs here.
Mexican migration, particularly from 2005 on, has slowed. We were seeing, even before the Great Recession, the beginnings of a slowdown in migration from Latin America, partly because construction jobs were beginning to dry up as the housing market started to peak and then began to decline starting in 2006. But the Great Recession had a big impact on the unemployment rate for immigrants, on the unemployment rate for all Americans, and on the unemployment rate particularly for Hispanic immigrants.
Despite the drop over the course of 2000 to 2014, taking all those years into account, Latinos still accounted for 54% of the nation's population growth. So still having a significant impact overall when we think about that, and will continue to, I would think, right?
That's exactly right. Our projections suggest that by 2065, Latinos will be accounting for about half of the nation's population growth between today and 2065. We also project, of course, that the Latino population will be a bigger share of the U.S. population in 2065 than it is today, reflecting faster growth among the Hispanic population than among the general U.S. population overall. So yes, while these the report that we put out suggests that Hispanic population growth rates are slowing, Hispanics are still growing at a faster rate than other groups of Americans, with the exception of Asian Americans. And that is going to drive U.S. population growth into the future.
Is there anything to indicate that because Latinos have driven so much of the population growth in the U.S. over the past 15 years, is there anything alarming about Latino population growth lessening, considering so much of the population growth has been driven by Latinos? Is that, in any way, is that a troubling sign, I guess, for the future population growth or future innovation, anything like that in the U.S.?
Some folks may say that the slowdown in Hispanic population growth is troubling for the demographic future of the country, but that's for others to decide. Nonetheless, even though Hispanic population growth is slowing, our population projections and our look at the data suggest that Latinos will still be an important part of the demographic story of the country over the course of the next 50 years. Perhaps more interestingly would be, how is the experience of U.S.-born Latinos in colleges and universities and ultimately in entering the labor market, how is that going to play out? Because the sorts of education, the levels of education and skills that they acquire will be important drivers for future U.S. labor force growth. And that, of course, is going to be important for the economy overall. But on demographics alone, Latinos will continue to contribute to U.S. population growth. But that's up to others to determine whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Mark Hugo Lopez is the director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. Since early this summer, Phoenix police have been asking the public to come forward and identify a serial killer they've connected to 7 homicides in the city. But residents say years of anti-illegal immigrant policies have made people hesitant to call law enforcement. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports.
Angela Vera is a small business owner and Blockwatch leader. She lives in a well-kept home in the heart of Maryvale, very close to where police say a serial street shooter murdered 2 people. Maryvale is one of Phoenix's most diverse areas and home to many undocumented immigrants. Vera says it's likely some have seen or heard things that may help police catch the killer, but that doesn't mean they'll call in a tip.
Because they're scared they'll be reported and taken by immigration.
Police say catching the serial street shooter hinges on the public sharing information. But a University of Arizona study on SB 1070's effect on young people found nearly half of participants would hesitate to call law enforcement. SB 1070 requires police, while enforcing other laws, to check a person's immigration status if they have reasonable suspicion they're in the country illegally. Scott Decker is a criminology professor at ASU. He says the hunt for a serial killer has revealed an unintended consequence of the law.
When the public loses confidence in their ability to be protected by law enforcement, then that hurts participation with law enforcement, cooperation, and that leads to more crime.
It's been 2 months since the serial shooter's last known attack. In August, the lead investigator took questions at a meeting in Northeast Phoenix.
He's charged with homicide.
Lieutenant Ed DeCastro gave few new details and reemphasized the need for public input.
So it's really going to come down to a tip and something that you guys can bring to us.
The reward for information leading to the arrest of the serial street shooter started at $11,000. To help motivate the public, it's been raised several times and now sits at $75,000. High-ranking law enforcement officials gathered for a news conference the last time the reward increased, and Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery promised not to look at the immigration status of victims or witnesses.
This is a team effort, everybody in the community, and we need them to participate.
Montgomery says he's had the same position going back to when SB 1070 first passed. Here's what he told police.
If the only reason you find out about someone's immigration status is due to their coming forward as a witness or a victim to a crime, do not investigate any further. We will not file any charges on that basis.
But not everyone in Maryvale knows Montgomery's stance. This summer, Phoenix police held meetings throughout the city as part of efforts to improve relations with residents. The meeting in Maryvale took place the day after police confirmed they're looking for a serial killer. Maria Rodriguez told the precinct commander that she trusted police before SB 1070. Now just seeing an officer scares her.
It was very frustrating when I saw an officer behind me because I'd say, they're going to deport me.
While much of SB 1070 has been struck down, key parts are still in effect. Again, ASU's Scott Decker.
And so the challenge that Mr. Montgomery faces, and it's a real and substantial challenge, is how to rebuild public trust in the community that's victimized the most, yet ironically trusts the police the least.
Decker says the search for the serial killer has compelled police and prosecutors to build rapport with the immigrant community.
When this person's caught, and when they're convicted, and when they're in prison, we need this outreach to continue.
If that happens, police could gain a new partner in the never-ending battle against crime. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
KJZZ reporters Jude Jaffe Block and Casey Kuhn contributed to this story. It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. If you live anywhere in the valley, you may notice tagged walls or bridges. In Tempe, the Graffiti Abatement Program works to keep neighborhoods and streets free of graffiti and unlicensed posters and stickers. Today, we step into a day on the job cleaning up graffiti.
358-360.
60.
What's your 20?
Well, we're on Fifth Street.
All right, hang out there. I'll be there in just a second.
Okay.
My name is Philip Chandler. I'm a transportation worker, too, for the city of Tempe, and I run the Graffiti Abatement Program. We are responsible for removing any graffiti, posters, stickers citywide that the residents in the city have deemed offensive or illegal or anything along those lines. It's going to depend on what it is and how big it is. We could be at a location anywhere from a minute to hours on end.
Every truck is equipped with a airless sprayer. It allows us to hook up the 5-gallon paint buckets. It's the most effective way to apply the paint to the surface with as little waste as possible. Most of the time, people don't realize how much graffiti they actually have in their alleyways until they get out and walk around. We have areas of this city that get tagged every day. Even when the police put up hidden cameras, they still get tagged. Every truck is also equipped with a high-pressure washer, so that graffiti on concrete, sidewalks, certain things, we can pressure wash off with a heated high spray water. This bridge is painted at least once a week. Let me grab my sprayer.
Nobody wants to drive through their neighborhood and see their walls tagged or their cars tagged or their entire city tagged. The downside with graffiti is we don't know what we're going to find on a day-to-day basis. Today it could be here, tomorrow it's over there, and it's back over there, and now it's back over here. But we do the best job we can.
That's Philip Chandler cleaning up graffiti in Tempe. The number of credit card skimmers discovered at gas station pumps around the state is still rising. The state has found 61 skimmer devices this year, almost half in the last month alone. Michelle Wilson is the Associate Director for the Arizona Department of Weights and Measures.
When we identify a skimmer, we check in the general geographical area because sometimes we find that they get installed and then maybe they drive a couple miles down the road and install one at another gas station. So we've seen them in little clusters.
Gas stations across the country have until October 2017 to install chip readers on pumps. Wilson suspects the people installing skimmers are trying to siphon as many credit card numbers as possible before that switchover. For right now, the security measures at stations vary.
Various locks on the inside of the dispensers or systems that'll actually shut the dispensers down if they're opened, or credit card information might be encrypted. So there's a wide variety of measures that different retailers put in place.
But she says there is no legal requirement for stations to have those security measures in place or to perform inspections. You may not be giving serious thought when you pull up to the pump and take out your credit or debit card and get ready to fill the tank, but a skimmer could be hidden very close to where you slide your payment card. To learn more about the impact skimmers are having, I turn to Brian Krebs, an independent investigative reporter who writes about cybercrime. Brian, even though other states and areas have been hit by skimmers, does it seem like the problem is bigger in Arizona?
It's difficult always to say whether we're just finding more of them because we're looking harder or if it really is becoming a bigger problem. But I think, by and large, it is not a problem that is limited to Arizona in terms of how much the incidence of skimming has increased over the years. A lot of the experts I talked to about this and asked, you know, why, would say, well, you know, the thieves, maybe they see the writing on the wall. They know that these credit cards without the more secure chips on them aren't going to be around much longer since they're phasing those out. They're trying to hit this cash cow as much as they can.
The gas stations always been the easiest targets because they're always the ones we hear about. I mean, do they fit into, are they just a small component of skimmer operations or are they sort of the main focus?
One of the dirty secrets in the filling station industry is that for many years, until very recently, you could have three or four different master keys that would open up the vast majority of the pumps in America. And so if the thieves got hold of one of these keys, it was very easy for them to pull up in a van next to one of the pumps, open up the doors on either side, start filling up the tank. And then meanwhile, somebody's in there fiddling with the inside of the pumps, attaching some skimming devices. Once you get inside and you're able to hook up your skimmer, you can hook it up directly to the power system. And that means you don't have to have batteries. And increasingly what they're doing is hooking up Bluetooth communication devices inside, which allow the thieves to come back every so often, pull up in a car or van with a laptop, and pull down all of the card data that's been stolen. And the other part about this that makes them very attractive is you leave a skimmer on the front of an ATM at a bank or somewhere else, it's probably going to last a couple of days, if that. Mm-hmm. If you go in and you're inside one of these pumps, it's probably going to be several weeks, maybe even a month or more, before the fraud gets detected.
Many years ago, we were all just sort of forced to go in the filling station, maybe pay with cash, maybe not, and then it became this amazing convenience to pay at the pump. Could this ever become enough of a problem where a lot of people or more people just decide, all right, I'm going to take an extra couple minutes and go stand in line?
I don't think so, mainly because oftentimes it's difficult to find somebody at these filling stations. You know, a lot of them are automated now. I tell people, if you're using a debit card at a filling station, that's probably not the best idea, especially if it asks you to enter your PIN. Because if you get it stolen, the liability protections aren't as great. And also, if you get your debit card or your checking account that's tied to it emptied out, you will eventually get that money back, assuming the bank or you detects it. But you're probably going to wait about a week before the bank sorts that out. And meanwhile, your money could be in limbo and, you know, you might be bouncing checks and things like that.
Anything related to law enforcement innovation you can tell us about? I imagine, again, since you're talking about low-hanging fruit, this is not a major priority for law enforcement, but are there any interesting innovative ideas you've heard about related to this sort of thing with skimming?
Actually, I think law enforcement cares a great deal about this, particularly the Secret Service. They can and do work with the banks to try to track and plot out where these attacks are happening. And the thing to remember is, whether it's Bluetooth enabled or not, the thieves still have to come back periodically to the scene of the crime. You know, that's part of the reason that these guys want to frequent pumps and filling stations that don't have things like cameras, because it makes it pretty easy for the authorities to figure out who these guys are and catch them the next time they come around.
Brian Krebs is an independent investigative reporter who covers cybercrime, including gas station skimming. You can find a map of where skimmers have been found in Arizona on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Today in Tucson, hundreds of local farmers, ranchers, chefs, and wholesalers are gathered to celebrate Arizona's growing food community. At the annual Arizona Farmer Chef Connection Conference, nonprofit advocacy group Local First Arizona connects our state's food producers with suppliers. The show's Lauren Gilger went out to visit one of those producers and joins us now. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
So you went to a farm in Queen Creek, is that right?
Yep, I went out to Sossaman Farms out by the Santan Mountains, where the grain is grown for Hayden Flour Mills. There are two local businesses that have partnered up to revive Arizona's heritage grain economy. So yes, this is the Hayden Flour Mills you're thinking of on Mill Avenue in downtown Tempe. But in 2010, Emma Zimmerman and her dad, Jeff, restarted it with the idea of bringing back the flour that Charles Hayden was milling in 1874.
So stone milling, we use renewable energy just like they did. So the old Hayden Flour Mills was powered by the Salt River, and ours is powered by the sun. And we use similar, actually the same variety of wheat that Charles Hayden was using at the time, white Sonora wheat. We've revived that variety of grain. So there's all these really cool historical parallels that we're doing. You know, it's not in Tempe, it's not on Mill Avenue anymore, but it's still in the spirit of Hayden Flour Mills, and we're hoping to kind of carry on that tradition.
And Lauren, Hayden Flour Mills is one of the local businesses at the Farmer Chef Connection Conference today.
They are. I met Emma Zimmerman at the mill, and she said they actually started their business at the Arizona Farmer Chef Connection years ago. Their first chef partner was Chris Bianco of Pizzeria Bianco. They started out in the back of one of his restaurants, and now they're selling to Whole Foods, Sprouts, and chefs all across the country. So Zimmerman and her four-month-old son, Fitz, you might hear him in there, showed me around the farm where they grow the grains and the mill where they grind and sift them.
It gets kind of dusty, so.
Flowery.
Yeah, this is actually our new mill because we're growing so much. So we have the stone mill here, and that weird looking box is a sifter where the grain comes through and we can get different fineness of grain, coarser grains, and sift out things that we don't want. But it's all really simple old technology. Stone grinding, sifting through screens.
So last year you participated in the Arizona Farmer Chef Connection. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like? What's it about?
So when we started our business, actually before we started our business, we went to Farmer Chef Connection. My dad had a little table and he just had a sign. And it was like, I have a mill, I need farmers, I need chefs. You know, let's get together and make this, revive the Arizona grain economy. And at that conference, he met Marco Bianco, who was like, hey, my brother Chris has been looking for local grain for years. So he became our first chef partner. And then we met Steve Sossaman, and he agreed to grow the grain. So then we had our kind of triangle of, you know, milling hub there. That all started at Farmer Chef Connection. So that conference really, it's our food community. And so you kind of go and people want to help you out and are happy to see new projects and they want to support them. So we go every year and it's kind of like, this is so cool. This is where we got started. And kind of we track our progress from there. Now this year we'll have a table that's full of like 25 different products and instead of just a little sign.
So it sounds like this event every year has created a real community here.
Yeah, well, I think it's a Farmer Chef Connection is a fun time to celebrate what's happening in Arizona in terms of food. And we go to other big shows like that, and we're always the little guy and kind of feel little. So it's fun to go to an event where it's all celebrating local, and you see other people that are working just as hard as you are to bring back, you know, like us, the grain economy or wines or vegetables or just, you know, really that care about Arizona and they're proud of what they're doing and the food they're making. And at the end of the event, there's always a showcase dinner and everyone contributes, you know, their product and they make this amazing meal. And it's like, kind of, that's kind of the reason I like to go.
That sounds amazing. So kind of, have you been here from the beginning and feel like you've been able to help shape this Arizona food community that's been created?
Yeah, well, it's cool because a mill is a great link in a food system. So we've enabled farmers to grow these heritage grains. And then on the other side, we have chefs supporting what we do. And there's just so many great chef-driven restaurants in Phoenix now and in Tucson. And they've been so, so supportive. And that's, you know, all those pieces have come together and we've been able to grow this project. And I think we can kind of say, yeah, we've revived the Arizona grain economy that was non-existent or had gone away since Charles Hayden's days.
And that was the show's Lauren Gilger at Hayden Flour Mills, speaking with Emma Zimmerman about the Arizona Farmer Chef Connection. Did you ever play with dolls or action figures as a kid? And did you ever create little friendships or relationships between them in your imagination? That's part of what Danny Newman does with his Super Newmans, which feature photos of action figures, including one that resembles Superman, going about the mundane activities of everyday life, including playing mini golf with the family or relaxing in the tub. Newman, who calls himself an action figure anthropologist, is one of the New Times 100 creatives. And Danny, how did you come up with that job title, action figure anthropologist?
It started when I began taking photographs where I would juxtapose a vintage action figure next to a modern counterpart of that very same character, which is happening now because we're living in like this golden age where everything that we had of a certain age as kids is now coming back again. So you had a Luke Skywalker figure as a child or a He-Man figure as a child. Well, we are getting updated versions of those very same characters using modern technologies and sculpting techniques and paint applications. And so I was enjoying doing this thing where I would take the vintage version of that character and set him next to the modern version of that character and take a bunch of photos of these things and just post them to a blog because I thought it was a neat visual reference. And I would write these blogs in completely made up, ridiculous, scientific sounding language. And I dubbed action figures with the Latin name Paramplasticus Populus, which I think would mean something like little plastic people.
You know, there's this dynamic that we always hear about, you know, gender roles, even as we're kids. And it's okay for girls to play with dolls, but boys aren't supposed to. It was almost like action figures were a way that boys could play with dolls too.
That is completely accurate. And that goes back to the history of when the term action figure was coined. I mean, in the late 50s, Mattel was killing it with Barbie dolls. I mean, it was gangbusters. And Hasbro no doubt saw that and thought, what about the boys' market? And they came up with this 12-inch military-style doll, but knew that if they called it a doll, it'd be like game over with the boys. And so at the 1964 Toy Fair, they introduced G.I. Joe as action figure, as an action figure. And that's when that term was coined.
At what point did you decide in your mind that this was going to be something more than just for yourself, that you really wanted to share it with other folks to see how it can be used either based on background or how they move or the artistry of your photos?
It happened organically. I would use it for personal projects. I enjoyed setting them up and taking pictures of them. And then I started blogging for a well-known action figure collecting website. And in those blogs, I would incorporate many of my photos. And to my sheer delight, people would respond well to the photos themselves. And that encouraged me a little bit more to keep doing that and pursuing it. And at a certain point, I had a fair amount of photographs of action figures. Like I'd kind of call it like on location. In other words, I'd take an action figure, I'd bring it out into a real environment, and I'd get, you know, really low to the ground with my camera to kind of skew the perspective a little bit and try to capture these little scenes where the action figure is maybe not an action figure. Maybe it's taking on a little bit more of a human real-life characteristic.
Why would we want to see Superman having to pick up his dogs, whatever, or mowing the lawn? Why does that appeal to you?
That you just gave me an idea for a shot, so thank you. I'm always fishing. I like the idea of humanizing these mythological characters and kind of bringing them down to a level that we can relate to. And I was sort of doing this before I started the Super Newmans, just taking characters that are iconic and having them do just everyday mundane things. For instance, I did a little series using like the Avengers, like Captain America and Thor and the Hulk and Iron Man. And it's a series of three shots, and it's called Downtime. And it's them riding bikes and hanging out at the skate park and performing in a garage band. Like, what are they doing when they're not saving the world? Can they just be normal? And with the Super Newmans, it adds a bit of interest for it to be an iconic superhero. Mm-hmm. So that just going right into it, I don't have to explain what is this character's powers, what can he do, what is the relationship with Lois Lane. Not that I ever use those names, but so that I can have just a quick shot of him using his heat vision and people aren't confused by that. Or, you know, like there was a shot where he went to the eye doctor and he was looking through the contraption that the eye doctor's put up to your face and like his heat vision accidentally went off and it's kind of exploding out of that machine. Like, what could go wrong if you're a superhero in everyday life?
So I was thinking about the 40-year-old virgin.
I knew this was going
to
come
up. When the Steve Carell character collects and then has a business going eventually to sell them. And then I was thinking about the increasing popularity and acceptance of Comic-Con, for example. Where is this crossing where initially maybe a person who did this was, all right, yeah, it's fine. The person can kind of be by himself in his mom's basement, as usually follow the phrase follows that. But now it's becoming, hey, more widespread and more pop culture again.
We're living in a tremendous age. It's amazing to see over the course of about 12 years, pop culture and geek culture, nerd culture, go from sort of a thing that you kind of had to keep a little bit buried to this thing that has wide acceptance. And I can do a thing like lay on my belly in a public place photographing action figures and not get looked at too strangely.
Danny Newman is a self-titled action figure anthropologist, and he's one of New Times 100 creatives. We'll be featuring other creatives on upcoming editions of the show.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.